I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation cure master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
Boys, I'm mellow as a honeydew. Yeah, that cat is high. Look at that look in his eye. Oh man, he's high. Yes, higher than a kite. That cat is high.
You're listening to The Speakeasy. I'm your host, Damon Bolte. Today in the studio, we have a very interesting man by the name of Phil Ward, who works at Myowell in the Lower East Side, New York City. Welcome to the show, Phil.
Thank you, Damon.
It's good to have you here. you've bartended at quite a few like classic cocktail bars around New York City. Pegu Club, Flatiron Lounge, some of the originals in the cocktail renaissance, I guess you could say, or the revival rather. Now you have a really great place called Myowell down on 6th Street between 1st and 2nd, correct?
Yep.
Cool. And at what capacity are you involved at Myowell?
Well, my employees would probably say I'm unemployed, but I guess you could say I'm the beverage director, one of the proprietors, I guess you could say I manage to some degree.
Cool. Now, a little bit about Myowell for the listeners, if they haven't been there before. It's focusing on more of the agave-based spirits. It's tequila and mezcal, and then some really great food, which we got to sample the other night, which was a lot of fun with a bunch of drunken bartenders, some Norwegians involved. How did this concept come about?
Well, like you said, my background was working at Flatiron, then Pegu, and then helping Dave Kaplan open Death & Company. And basically, it was all just an evolution. We were talking earlier about classic cocktails, and when you read old, that's basically how I figure that I learned how to make drinks, was through reading old books and classic cocktails and working with Julie, who actually taught me what a cocktail was, and then working with Audrey. But essentially, when you read all those old books and learn how to make drinks, there weren't very many classic tequila cocktails. And as a bartender, you always want to create something new. And naturally, I just started gravitating towards tequila and scotch, because those were the two really great spirits that you didn't read about as much in classic cocktails. And basically, Flatiron 3 years, Pegu Club for a little over a year, about 3 months, made drinks. Most of the drinks I actually did get on those menus was probably with tequila, the first one being a revived Diablo at Flatiron. But it was something that it seemed like needed to be done. It was something that it's tequila. Obviously, it's A, delicious, B, versatile, and C, it seemed to work really well. So when D&C was really up and going, we had about probably 60 to 80 drinks on the list, and we broke the menu down according to spirit and stirred and shaken. And a lot of the nights there, a quarter of the drinks at least would be tequila and mezcal that we were making.
That's interesting.
And, there was an opportunity where I had somebody approach me and said, I have a space, and what should we do with it? And it pretty much seemed like a no-brainer, because, you had Death & Company where, we were pretty renowned for making good drinks, and the people who came there were people who really were educated. Well, I don't know if educated is the right word, but people who were familiar with what they thought good drinks were. and came there because it was a place where they thought the good drinks were. And, you know, some nights, you know, we'd do more tequila drinks than anything else. So it really was just a no-brainer to try to do a bar that exclusively, you know, highlighted those spirits. Especially if you take into consideration, at the time, you know, there were tequila bars in New York, but it seems like with tequila bars, it's more a matter of like, not, you know, it was just, oh, I have 150 bottles of tequila on my back bar,
and you 200. Don't know what to do with them or anything about them.
Yeah, and people still loved that. They loved going to a tequila bar and drinking tequila and eating bad Mexican food and things like that. And that was already popular, and cocktail bars were already popular. So it was like, hell, why not combine the two? And, you know, have two things that people love. And then on top of that, with the food, you know, there was a lot of places in New York where you could get a good drink or good food. But there weren't many that you could do it under one roof with one, you know, cohesive idea behind it, this being Mexico.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there are so many transplants in New York City from different parts of the country and obviously different parts of the world. But for me, personally, I really like going to Mayawell because it's the kind of food that I grew up around, being from like around Oklahoma and Texas, you know, lots of really great Mexican food, but we didn't necessarily have great tequila cocktails or anything like that. And it never really made sense to me because there are only a few different types of cuisine that make sense when you pair cocktails with them. Like, there's like dark and bitter and boozy with like lots of like heavy, rich like meats and stuff like that. Then there's like Polynesian, like tiki drinks. Those go well together. You can actually pair those with food.
Barbecue and whiskey.
Barbecue and whiskey.
That's, or mezcal.
Yeah. And then Mexican food with tequila and mezcal-based drinks. It's definitely a no-brainer because you've got so many transplants like myself coming into the city, and they're missing that. Also, those harsh New York winters, it's like you want a little sunshine in there, and you can have that year-round, you know? So, that's really great. You've been considered to be one of the leading experts in the bar world on mezcal and tequila, agave-based spirits. How did that come about? I mean, like, I know you've been, you were telling me earlier about the tequila interchange project, and talking about meeting up with Ron Cooper from Del Maguey. How did this all start? I mean, you were obviously passionate about making these cocktails, but how did you get so involved with the that world?
It was the mezcal my mother put in my milk as a child. No, honestly, I feel really guilty about this because, you know, tequila is something that I really, really always enjoyed and thought was a really great spirit. And once I tasted mezcal, it was really on in earnest. Mm-hmm. But really, it when you come down to it, I mean, Mayawell was like a business decision. You know, it was something that I knew worked and was something that was just, it was such a no-brainer that if, you know, I don't think there will ever be anything that obvious to me the rest of my life, but but since that time, and, you know, the 6 or 7 times I've been in Mexico, you know, in the last 2 years or whatever that it's open, I've just simply positively fallen in love with the place, you know, and there's, you know, I'm very lucky, you know, I got to meet people like Ron Cooper and David Suro and travel in Mexico with these people. And, you know, it's not even just about the spirits anymore. It's about, like, the country that it's from and the time you spend there. And it really was an evolution more than anything. But I think everything in life is an evolution. You know, you don't just decide you want to be this or that. It's, you grow into it and things like that. And that's sort of like what happened. I really wish my mother would have put mezcal in my milk. I would have been ahead of the game, but she didn't.
It's interesting. I really want to talk about this. The tequila interchange project, and I find that fascinating. Like, because I have quite a few friends now that are opening up their own places, and it wasn't necessarily what they were going to do like a couple 3 years ago, but it's. It's kind of like exactly what you were talking about. You get to a certain point where, just in the same way about like making cocktails, inventing cocktails, like we were talking about before, and we'll get to in a moment. You kind of have to like pay your dues and then like work up from the classics. Same thing with business. You've got to figure out like the fundamentals of running a business and, you know, inventory and ordering,
blah blah blah
blah blah blah, 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 all that crap. But But I think it's really neat that that played out that way for you. Now, during these travels down to Mexico and to Oaxaca and the Gordon Triangle and whatnot, you've been working with this organization called the Tequila Interchange Project. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, the Tequila Interchange Project was started by David Suro, who's one of the nicest human beings on Earth. Owns really, he probably arguably had one of the first tequila bars, even though it was a restaurant in Philadelphia called Tequila's. Mm-hmm. That opened.
Place is awesome.
Yeah, that opened like almost a quarter of a century ago. And basically, David's a very passionate man, and you know he loves tequila. Obviously, he has his own brand, Sangre Azul. But even before that, probably made him blush that I even named his brand, because he cares about tequila as a whole so much more than that.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of issues in tequila right now. You know, with the plants and how they're all cloning, and you mm-hmm. know, there's a really big fear that there could just really easily be like a really bad plague and really. He really thinks the future of tequila is really threatened by like the production habits and things like that.
Absolutely.
And so basically what he did was he started this program called the Tequila Interchange Program, which involves usually about 8 bartenders going down to Mexico to the tequila region with professors from the University of Guadalajara, and we travel around Mexico, and you know, we'll have archaeologists, agronomists, many different kinds of professors who, and it's like time traveling, because you know, it's not just going down to see tequila, it's going down to be Mexico and learn Mexico. And maybe if Rodolfo hears this, hello Rodolfo, you're the coolest human being on Earth. He kind of reminds me of Dr. Spock. But anyways, it's just really about trying to raise awareness about what's going on in tequila, and you know, working with tequila distilleries and things like this, and really just trying to educate the consumer about what is happening in Mexico.
Yeah.
And trying to make longevity of tequila better than just like short-term, you know, economical benefits for those who are trying to produce it.
You know, another thing, like, I was down at his restaurant in Philadelphia maybe a year and a half ago or so. Maybe it was just about a year ago. And I really liked, he did this huge presentation in their like private dining room for a bunch of bartenders that came down from New York City. About exactly what you're talking about, and the way that it's like seemingly almost like there's a plague coming to the tequila world. But one of the things that really caught my attention is that he was talking about the humidor.
Yeah.
And how it's kind of like a dying art. And
yeah.
That in itself is something that's that could potentially like hurt the tequila industry.
Yeah, that's one of David's biggest things is the humidor. But it's not even just the humidor. It's just basically the Mexican people as a whole. Like
yeah.
Just some of the distilleries down there. You know, the way they take advantage of the people who live there, or, you know, there's one, you know, I'm not going to name names because I've learned to wisen up, but, you know, there's one particular town where the town doesn't even have water sometimes because the distillery, which is making, I don't know, millions or billions of dollars a year, takes all the damn water from this town. And it's just, it's regrettable. And, you know, David does use the humidors as a poster child, you know, because you have generations and generations of people who, you know, like, you learn, like, good example is like when you go down there, you know, when you plant agave, you don't, you know, you plant them all next to each other at the same time, mm-hmm. you know, but in 8 years, Bob over here on the left side is done, but Rico on the right side, he's not done. And how do you tell that? And you ask a humidor that, and you know, they have a few different little clues about it, but at the end of the day, it's really, they just kind of know because they've been in those fields for 8 years, and their father taught them how to know when a plant
they've
is,
seen it every
when a
day.
Plant is, yep. is, you know, is
mature,
you know, and that's something that really concerns him a lot. And you know, it's a valid thing, because you know, a lot of humidors now, a lot of places, you know, the price of agave is very, very low right now. And a lot of humidors, you know, they can make more money picking potatoes in Idaho or something, you know. so a lot of them are leaving, and you know, there's no way to replace that knowledge.
Speaking of leaving, we're going to take a quick break, but we are definitely going to come back, and we'll continue to talk with Phil Ward of Maya Well in New York City about agave and tequila-based and mezcal-based cocktails. Be right back.
He was catching dirt from his head to his foot, his hair so black that it looked like soot. Well, he reined in his mule and he hitched him to the rail and he said, old feller, it's the end of the trail. Well, he ambled down to the old saloon. He said, I know it's early and it ain't quite noon, but hey, hey, everybody drink on me. Everybody have a drink, have a drink, have a drink on me. Everybody have a drink on me. Hey, hey, everybody drink on me. Said my uncle died and left an oil well to me. Hey, hey, everybody drink on me. I've been digging all my life and I nearly dug to hell, but my uncle dug potatoes and he struck an oil well. Oh, hey, hey, everybody drink on me. Let me hear you, man. Have a drink, have a drink, have a drink on me. Everybody have a drink on me. Hey, hey, everybody drink on me.
This is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Tuesday at noon, Dave Arnold, the author of CookingIssues.com, will discuss new and innovative techniques, equipment, and ingredients. Call in with your own questions to see if Dave and the crew can solve your cooking issues. Again, that's Tuesdays at noon on the Heritage Radio Network.
Keeping something at a static...
And we are back. We have Phil Ward in the studio. We've been talking about agave-based spirits like mezcal and tequila and the market for them and basically the economy of Mexico and how it's been fluctuating lately due to all kinds of different aspects. The humidor, the cloning of the plants. There was also, I feel like, it was like about 10 years ago, if not more. It might have been like the mid to late 90s. There was a huge tequila agave drought. And I think it was a couple of different reasons? Was it just because of the over-harvesting? I thought there was also like something similar to like a phylloxera breakout or something.
I mean, it was several things. There was a little bit of a plague for the plants. And there was also, you know, tequila's grown a lot over the 10 years. And they didn't foresee that growth. Mm-hmm. But pretty much, you know, like I've talked to David a lot about this, and it's pretty much it's cyclical. You know, there's always a cycle. There's a shortage, so everybody plants, and then there's too much, so nobody does. Like right now, there's people. You know, when you travel around Jalisco now, you'll see like a lot of abandoned fields and things like that, or more corn and things like that, because the price of agave right now is so low. So what will happen is everybody will stop planting, and it's not like wheat or like corn or something that only takes a year. We're talking about almost a decade from now when those plants will be mature. So everybody will stop planting now, and then we'll have a shortage. So it's pretty much seems like it's been like that forever. You know, one thing they have talked about is trying to make a minimum price, or I don't know what the economic term is, but a standardized price for agave. So, you know, like now, it's basically now a producer, you know, asked people to make, you know, grow this much blue agave for them at this price 8 years ago when there wasn't as much, but now there's so much, and it, you know, they've grown these agaves on small plantations and things like that, and then they come back and they say, oh, no, I'm going to give you this price instead of that price, and what the hell is the guy going to do because he has agaves that he can sell or rot?
Do you think there's any influence, like, from... like agave nectar being sold? This is kind of like on subject, but a little bit off. But you know, agave nectar became a very popular sweetener, like a healthier sweetener option over the last, you know, 5 to 7 years. It's really blown up in the last 4 years, seemingly. Yep. Do you think that has anything to do with the fact that now there is an abundance of agave, or do you think
I think it was all tequila. I mean, when you think about it, like the plants that were planted 8 years ago, there wasn't that market for agave. But that's a really interesting thing I haven't thought about. Maybe that is one of the reasons why you see so many agave nectars on the market.
It kind of freaks me out. And I kind of want to just take it home and distill it.
Yeah. Yeah, but actually, though, I guess it's a really good thing, because if there wasn't agave nectar, there'd probably be even a lower market price for the agave that they make tequila with.
Absolutely. Speaking of...
Are you dry?
I am dry. We've been sampling some really nice... I'm just going to pass it over. One of your favorite producers, probably your favorite.
Yes.
And one of my favorite guys, too, Ron Cooper from Del Maguey Mezcal.
Which just won Distiller of the Year at the San Francisco Spirits Tasting, I'd like to mention.
Cool.
But
congratulations, Del Maguey. Thank you.
Well earned.
Absolutely.
But what we're drinking now is Pechuga, made by Luis at in the town of Minas. Last time I was there, he sold us a bottle of Pechuga, which is a third distillation of a Del Maguey Mezcal called Monero, distilled a third time with when the fruits of the season are in season, wild plantains, wild mountain apples, anise, uncooked white rice, almonds, cinnamon, and they hang a skinless washed raw chicken breast in the still.
Nice.
And this is only the body of the batch. There's no heads or tails.
Oh, nice.
And, well, and Stiji Bayou. That's what they say down there.
Oh, sweet.
Stiji Bayou. It means like to you, to your friends, to the earth. And then they say Bakin, which means drink.
Okay, Bakin. It's amazing. A little bit about Del Maguey. They come on the market, like 3 or 4 years ago?
Oh, no, it was longer than that.
Really?
Del Maguey was started by a gentleman called Ron Cooper, who I think of as the Yoda of Mezcal. According to him, it started as a joke between him and his friend in a bar one night when they asked if the Panamanican Highway really existed. So basically what they did was took a car from Alaska and drove the Panamanican Highway all the way down to Oaxaca. And Ron's also a somewhat famous artist, and when they got to Oaxaca, he discovered Mezcal. And when he was in Oaxaca and discovered Mezcal, he loaded up a whole truckload of Mezcal to bring back to the States. And when he got to the border to bring him back to the States, the border guard said, "You can't bring that in here." And Ron turned his car around and went back to Mexico, and he swore that day that he was going to figure some way to get Mezcal into the country for all his friends. And Del Maguey was born. And Del Maguey is basically the umbrella company for single village Mezcals. There's five different villages who are all part of the company, and you know they're all independent. Each distiller or Palenquero, you know, they make their own Mezcal their own way, and they're all different. But I'm pretty sure it's the most amazing spirit on earth.
Yeah, it's very good. My favorite, which is, I do like the Pechuga and the Monero, but I really like the Chichicapa,
yeah.
Which is like, yeah, just well, so I always, smoky and nice.
I always refer to having affairs with each bottle. Because you know, I was on the big Chichicapa train for a while. Right now, me and Monero have been spending a lot of time together. But you know, one of the words that I always hate is best. I don't really believe in the word best as so much as different, because each one of these is so unique and so delicious in their own different way. And you know, we're creatures of mood and things like that. So there's different days and different moods and different bottles you want to reach for.
Cool. Yeah. Absolutely. Same with, you know,
whiskey,
you
rum, know. Whatever.
I feel like there was something cool that you said earlier about, well, not very cool, but like kind of unfortunate about the fact that people have become over the last decade or so more educated on tequila and agave-based spirits and mezcal. And what happened was it blew up so fast that, you know, it was hard to keep up, and that's kind of like what's happening with rye whiskey right now too. Because you remember, like in the late '90s, early 2000s, like people started really finding out about like quality tequilas. Up until a certain point, they had that night of tequila shots in college of like Montezuma or whatever, and then they swore it off until like their, you know, mid 20s, and they started learning that there were actually some good tequilas out there. Based on that, do you think now, like going back to what we were saying, do you think it's going to, do you think we'll see another like agave drought anytime soon? Or because I'm kind of afraid to think about the way that now, like with bars like yours, and there's a lot of places on the West Coast. I was out there in San Francisco a couple months ago, and God, they drink so much freaking tequila, and it's become very popular, and for good reason. Do you foresee any kind of like shortage coming up anytime soon?
It could happen, but one of the wonderful things about mezcal versus tequila is tequila, you know, they chose that you had to use only blue agave to make tequila, you know, because that was a plant that matured faster and it was a quicker turnover time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, whereas mezcal can be made from, you know, up to, you know, 25, 26, even more than that agaves. So while there could be a shortage and things like that, and while most of it is made from espadine, there still is other, it's not just all one type of agave to make it from. And also a lot of these are, you know, some of them are wild or semi-cultivated. So they're still really choosing where they want to live and choosing, you know, kind of evolving. Mm-hmm. So they're not as susceptible to like plagues or diseases and things like that, because they're not all clones of each other.
Yeah.
So I mean, that is one good thing. But I mean, there's no doubt that, you know, I really fear that mezcal will become a victim of its own success, the way tequila is. Like the number, you know, we've been open for 2 years at Mayawell, and I think about, you know, the number of new tequila producers who have come in there to taste me on things. It just makes me want to cry more than carry it, you know.
Are you carrying Justin Timberlake's tequila?
I don't know who that is.
Yeah, I don't either.
but no, so I'm sure, you know, you already do have some mezcals that are coming out that aren't very good quality, and it's really trying to take advantage of, you know, the really hard work that people like Ron Cooper's been doing for almost two decades.
Yeah.
Steve Olson as well, we should also give a nod out to him, because he's helped Ron along in his journey to where we are now, which I really feel guilty about, because I almost feel like I'm just taking advantage of all the work that those guys did. But at the end of the day, I guess it's better for mezcal. But you are going to see that, you know, like there's unsmoked mezcals out now and things like that. It's like, it's a joke, you know?
Yeah. We have a few more minutes left. You have another bottle in front of you. Would you like to try that out?
Yeah. This is a bottle of mezcal from Durango, the Durango region of Mexico, made from the Maguey Sanizo, if I'm pronouncing that right. I procured this bottle at my favorite bar in the world, Pere de Sufrer, in Guadalajara. Nice. Owned by a gentleman with the very conspicuous name of Pedro Jimenez. Pedro, my friend Ryan Fitzgerald from San Francisco, he told me about Pere de Sufrer, I guess last year at some time when I was heading down to Guadalajara. And I've decided in the 4 or 5 times I've been there since, it's my favorite bar in the world. It's very simple. Pedro's one of the nicest guys I've ever met, and his mezcal selection is just silly. Last time I was there, I decided that we went down the last tip trip. I think we visited him 3 times, maybe 4. But I decided that Forrest Gump was wrong, that life isn't a box of chocolates, like his mama said. It's a mezcal at Pere de Sufrer, because you never know what the hell you're going to get. Is this every mezcal is just so different and amazing.
Absolutely.
And it's a very simple place. Just, he's only open Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, because I believe he does something in movies or something too. But just very bare bones place. Very simple snacks. He sells tamales. Has a DJ who's always awesome. Like, it's, I don't know the music very well because I'm not from Mexico, but it sounds very, very good. Who just spins every night, and it's very, very neat place.
Awesome.
And so this one's to Pedro.
It's to Pedro. Before we sign off, Phil, I definitely would like to have you back sometime as a guest, because I feel like we have so much more to talk about. Is there any way that people can look up the Tequila Interchange Project? Is there a website?
Yeah, there's a website.
Okay. Do you have that that information for us right now?
It's just, I think it's like www.tequilainterchangeprogram.com.
Okay, cool.
Or just Google it.
Cool, man. That's what I usually just do anyway.
Yeah.
Man, I really want to thank you so much for being on the show today. And like I said, you got to come back sometime. We can get a gang of kids in here and talk about Table 42.
Okay.
I want to thank you again. I want to thank the Heritage Food USA. I want to thank my producer, Jack Inslee. And also, I want to thank Katie and Patrick Martins from Heritage Foods. We had a great time on Sunday at Del Posto. Check out next week. I'm not sure who's on. I can't remember right now, but I'm sure it'll be somebody very fun to drink with and talk about booze. Thanks, Phil. Cheers.
Thank you, Damon. You know that cat's been drinking,
got no shoes upon his feet. Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. You know I wouldn't lie, he's higher than the sky. The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. The Snacky Tunes compilation has arrived and is available for free on our website, heritageradionetwork.com. This compilation features live performances from some of the hottest acts around today, including Midnight Magic, Surfer Blood, Oberhofer, and more. Again, you can download this compilation for free on our website, heritageradionetwork.com, and make sure to listen to Snacky Tunes every Monday at 2 p.m. on Heritage Radio Network.